All right, with that, let's go to John chapter 18. We will be in verses 12 through 27 this morning. Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door outside. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers who had made a fire of the coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves. And Peter stood with them and warmed himself. Then the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, "I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? And those who have heard me, what I said to them, indeed, they know what I said." And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. Therefore, they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter then denied again, and immediately a rooster crowed.
You know what it felt like? It felt like dad strength. You know, when you were a kid and you're wrestling with your dad, you know, and he's just taking all the hits and he's toying with you, and then boom, he just takes you down. Jesus setting me straight that day. That felt a lot like that. Okay, I know. Hindsight is 20/20, but at that time and at that moment, I just couldn't figure out what he was talking about, you know? I mean, why did he have to suffer? Why did he have to die? No. Not on my watch. This wasn't going to happen. No, sir. It just wasn't like he was thinking straight, you know? I kept thinking maybe he's dehydrated. Maybe he's hungry. The man never got enough to eat, if you ask me. So I take him aside, and I start laying into him, and before I could even get very far, he stops me, he looks me in the eyes, because he has those eyes, and you know what he said to me? "Get behind me, Satan." Dad strength. Those words, those eyes, that moment floored me. He floored me. But I mean, seriously, get behind me, Satan. All right, I admit I have some flaws, you know, but Satan, I mean, that stung a bit, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I just didn't get it. I just didn't see the whole picture, which won't be the last time that'll happen, mind you. You see, I wanted him to use that dad strength on the world, you know? I mean, my desires, my plans. And your boy Peter's plans, they don't always work out so good, i.e. ear slicing, etc. But he knew all along, he would give us just enough rope for allow us to figure things out for ourselves. And then he had that dad strength, you know? He'd pull us back in. Right at that moment, we needed saving from ourselves. That was his plan all along. Saving us from ourselves. saving me from myself.
Throughout the gospel accounts of the life and times of Jesus Christ, there has been many attempts that have been made by the enemies of our Lord to lay hands on him, to do him harm. If you're a student of the word, you know those accounts. But because his hour had not yet come, he always eluded those who aimed to take him early. Then, just before this text in John, a couple of verses before we began today, we have an account of Jesus who, incredibly, with just his words, caused the band of soldiers to literally be blown back onto the ground. You know the account. Just his words. So, what was their response? Tie him up next time. I mean, can you imagine the scene that was going on there? Trying to stop the power of God with some ropes after what they had just seen. It's just that Jesus was ready now. He allowed himself to be taken by sinful hands. Jesus now begins his journey to the cross by appearing before a man by the name of Annas. Now, Annas wasn't even the official high priest at that time, though he certainly wielded the power behind the scenes. History on the secular realm has much to say about this man, Annas, who was apparently one of the most brilliant, clever, and quite possibly the most satanic of all of the high priests. Apparently, this Annas had historically, officially, surrendered his position of high priest to his son-in-law, Caiaphas. That's why we see both of these appearing in the account. But having done so, Caiaphas was still essentially just a mere puppet ruler at the hands of Annas, as proven in this case with Jesus. Now, it is believed by many commentators that it was Annas that he surrendered his position, at least partially, because he wanted more time to devote himself to the business, quote unquote, of religion within the temple. It would seem that he was inadvertently the recipient of Jesus, who had previously overturned the tables of the money changers. It was Annas' money and Annas' business that was being overturned. Also, many of those who were there that day wrongly capitalizing on the marketing of religion. Now, again, many commentators believe that it was Annas who actually was behind the whole play for Jesus because of these issues. His arrest, his death sentence. Annas was most definitely politically connected. And certainly he had an awful lot to lose because of Christ and because of the spread of Christianity. Jesus would now, firstly, be tried in a religious trial, if we can call it that at all. A trial that would try to falsely paint him as guilty of blasphemy. And then they would take him to be tried in a mock civil trial in an attempt to find him guilty of insurrection and guilty against crimes against the state. Now, while folks, I think for generations who have read the account of Peter before us and the arrest of Jesus, can kind of come to this story with an incredulous, if not self-righteous, kind of judgment. Somehow that we would be innocent, that we would stand outside of all this fray, that this would never happen if we had been involved. And yet the truth is, we shouldn't be surprised at what was occurring here. If, again, if you're a student of the Word and you see things in that linear way, you will know that things had not been going well for Peter for quite some time. This wasn't out of the blue, if you will. Peter was an enthusiastic guy. He was often self-willed. He was sometimes impulsive and at times even brash. But for all of his strengths, and he did have strengths, for all of his strengths, Peter had several failings in his life also. Still, the Lord who chose him continued to mold him into exactly who he intended Peter to be, and I find great comfort in that fact this morning. One thing God always seems to give us, and experientially, maybe you are already aware of this morning, but one thing God always seems to give us is time to regain our balance. Time to correct our life trajectory when we find ourselves in such spiritual spins. I dare say none of us will ever stand before the Master at the day of judgment and go, "Hey, you just didn't give me a chance." Oh, he gave us a chance. A wonderful chance. It's called grace. And he gave it to us over and over. Despite Peter's past stumbles, despite all the reasonings that he may give or that we may look at and reason out, the heart of Peter's downfall seemed to come excessively from a large ego. Many such stories begin at that point. I think even with us today. Hindsight's 20/20, they say. No doubt Peter was thinking that about the time this last verse of this passage was lived out. Hindsight 20/20. But again, these events that transpired in this passage today, the events that transpired that night that we read about here, they were long in coming. Firstly, they began even as far back as Matthew 16:22, where just like the video recounted, Peter contradicted Jesus' words. And he argued Jesus' plan. I know none of us would ever be so guilty and presumptuous, right? Peter that day went so far as to actually take Jesus aside and actually rebuke the Son of God. Jesus had been telling his apostles of his coming arrest and how this would all play out. And Peter was quick to reject that plan, saying, "Oh, far be it from you, Lord, that this should happen to you." And in order to give Peter no later excuse for behavior, Jesus was quick to seriously come back at him for his words and his actions. That's a problem when we sin so publicly and speak so publicly, we have no choice than to correct publicly. Whatever Peter might have felt about that correction, it did not ultimately deter him from barreling on ahead. That event then was just the beginning of Peter's undoing. Secondly, it seemed that on more than one occasion, Peter would rely on his own strength instead of upon Christ. Once again, how can we even identify with that, right? Peter thought that he could never deny his Lord. Oh, no, not me. And he was so verbal, so quick to verbally claim as much, too. He believed in his own strength and his own stamina. This heart in action would be Peter's second fatal error. Third, when things proved to be out of his control, as in this scene of the garden arrest, Peter turned to carnal weapons. He forgot that ultimately our battle wasn't against flesh and blood, and he took on fleshly weapons to fight a spiritual war. Yeah, you know, those kind of weapons don't work in the realm of the spirit. Jesus rebuked Peter on the spot once again. And even he went so far as to clean up Peter's mess by healing the ear of Malchus. And despite such an incredible save on the part of Jesus, Peter still, even now, didn't pull up. Then fourth, and yes, by this time things were in full swing. The game was on. The scripture records, and once again, sadly, for all of history to read, the account records that Peter followed afar off. According to the other gospel accounts, we know that Peter didn't run away per se, but he also didn't join Christ in the middle of the fray either. Oh yes, he followed, and maybe you're in that situation today and you're saying, but I'm following. But just like so many of us do, Peter was following way back. Many of us think too that we can be okay with Jesus, just as long as we keeping him in sight, even if he is way up ahead of us, out of the range of fellowship, and where we cannot hear his voice. Then, his fifth mistake, well along now in this spiritual slide, Peter made the mistake of accepting a place in the company of Christ's enemies. Peter saddled up to the foes of Christ and to his followers. He warmed himself beside the fires of the enemy. He warmed himself at the fires of the enemy. Essentially, he sought comfort while Jesus suffered. Hey, Christian, are you seeking comfort? You see, Peter attempted to blend with the world, and he did so to try to stay out of the chaos. Essentially, Peter was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And we're not completely sure of his motives for what he was doing at that moment. I dare say Peter didn't even know what his motives were at that moment. But he wasn't there to evangelize, was he? He was not the salt and the light that we are called to be in the world. Now, oftentimes we will try to make excuses for warming ourselves around the fires of the enemy, saying that we are doing just that. But the only one being fooled is us. Peter was warming himself around the fires of the enemy. And again, I can't help but wonder, in a crowd this size, how many of us are doing the same today? Maybe like Peter, you think playing both sides will protect you. And so you got the Sunday church thing going. But see, all these people that are around you here on Sundays, they're not with you, you know, on Tuesday mornings and Thursday afternoons and Friday evenings. So your self-preservation tendencies are in control. Peter, too, was there because he ironically thought he was safe in that place, and nothing could be further from the truth. We can easily err in that same way, can't we? Hanging out a little with those who seek to undermine your church? Those who seek to undermine the kingdom of God? And maybe you're thinking, oh yeah, Pastor, but it's okay. It's just through email. It's just that we're Facebook buddies. But in the end, it really doesn't make any difference. Now, I know in your pride, you think that you're going to pull it off and that you're going to dance between two worlds and it'll be all right. I'm sure Peter thought so too. Now, maybe today I could go so far as to acknowledge that you too are spiritually cold and you are spiritually tired, and maybe you're confused, and maybe you're lonely, and you're hurting, and we can look at Peter, and we can excuse his behavior for that kind of a situation he was in. And then I would ask you, where do you go when you feel that way? Where do you go when you're cold and you need to get warm? Back to the world? So now, primed and ready, the seeds sown and the investments made, Peter would make the biggest mistake of his whole life. One that would literally echo down through the ages, so very public, so very shaming. And recording it all for history would apparently be John, Peter's unwitting biographer who was trailing along beside him. And it makes me always very cognizant of the fact that someone's always watching. We're never really alone. The world is watching. And what makes all of this even worse is that day at this point in his life and this denial that occurred. What makes this even worse is that, at least at first here, Peter was truly without excuse. I mean, he was even without fleshly excuse. He didn't cower before an armed soldier. He cowered before a simple young girl who kept the door. You see, I dare say, and I will never know until I'm on the other side what Peter's full emotions and motives were, but you know, I cannot help but feel that Peter that day was not primarily concerned about his skin. It was his life as a whole he was concerned about. The life he had known up to that moment was all slipping away. And he couldn't stop it. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like that. I just can't get my hands around it. See, because ultimately, he wasn't just being asked if he knew Jesus. He was essentially being asked how much he loved him. How much he loved his calling. And how much he trusted Jesus. Oh, Peter, remember the walking on the water? Why did you not believe? Where was your faith? And here again, being tested again. How much do you love me, Peter? That's a test that I promise that each and every one of you that is here today, we all will experience that in our lives. Probably more than once. We will all take that test. It is a crossroads where we will find ourselves either all in or it's time to run. Maybe you know people. Maybe you have friends who came to that point and they too had that moment where they were like, I got to be all in or I got to run. And they ran. Many will turn their back on Jesus when they too have to drink of his blood and eat of his flesh. John 6:53 and 66 speaks of this. Then Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. What does it mean to eat of his flesh and drink of his blood? It is to embrace not just the life and the ministry and the commitment of Jesus Christ, but it is to embrace the idea of dying to this world. To take that same road, to follow that same path Jesus was on. And many of us, when we come to that clear understanding, that's where we draw the line and say, no more. I won't. Annas, now that he has Jesus in front of him, begins an information search. And this would be just the beginning of what would be 24 hours of grilling. Endless questions that nobody really wanted to hear the answers to. I mean, the high priest here begins to quiz Jesus on his beliefs and on his followers. Now, please note how this was happening, and we can, if we know the story, we can roll right on by without really realizing that there was some real abnormalities to what was going on here. I mean, the Sanhedrin hadn't been assembled at this point. So this wasn't in any way a real or legal trial. The whole thing was a charade. The whole thing was illegal. Merely asking Jesus what he did was illegal. They too have a provision in their law which allowed a person not to incriminate oneself. But the high priest, I think, wasn't really too concerned about what was right or legal. I mean, if that was the case, he wouldn't have been there at this mock trial in the middle of the night. Jesus tells the high priest that what he did and what he had done openly. And he had done publicly. He was not organizing a secret army to somehow gain earthly power. He wasn't trying to overthrow the Roman government, nor was he trying to overthrow the church at the time, at least not in that kind of mentality. And unlike clandestine Peter, who was outside at that moment telling lies, Jesus was still out in the open, inside, telling the truth as he always had. That's the thing about, warming oneself around the fires of the enemy. It's all done in the dark. It's all done in the secret. And hear me on this. That's the proof that you know what you're doing. People will, try to take the high road and you're justified in your behavior and you're righteous in what you're doing and it's all okay the way you're handling things. Then why are you doing it in secret? Why are you doing it in the dark? The very fact that you are is proof that you know that it's wrong and further that you shouldn't be doing it at all. Such acts of treason are done in whispers and they're done in shadows. Again, secret emails. Passing notes under the table. And those who are party to that kind of behavior, they will not come out into the open and into the light and speak their words. But Jesus did. Jesus did. He encouraged the high priest to go and ask those who had heard him speak and who had heard him minister over the previous 3 years. Go ask those guys. Ask those guys if what I said. Ask those guys what I did. Ask them what my ministry has been like. And let me tell you, gang, Jesus is our role model when it comes to this. This is why we as a church always deal with conflict in the light of day. It has been my practice as a lead pastor here from the very beginning. When we get in those situations, we just get everybody into one big room and burn it down. Okay, now, let me see. You said this, right? Okay, Betty, what did he say? That's the way it's handled. Just so you know. We We put things out there in the light of day. The fruit of Jesus' ministry is his defense, just as it is ours. When you're transparent, you got nothing to hide. A lot of folks, again, they don't like the light, and they're going to quickly scurry away at any suggestion of such a public discussion. When these folks didn't like the answer Jesus gave, what was their response? Their response was violence. Again, that's a classic response to truth by those who do not want to hear the truth. And if you think that there are limits to what I just said, because I don't believe there are any, then you need to turn on the news and watch some politics. So it's a classic response. People lash out in attack mode. Jesus, however, he just stands by the truth. I mean, if he'd been lying, his attitude was, bring it on. Bring it on. I'm here before you. But notice, no one was much interested in that day, were they? They wanted rather to silence the truth, not debate it. Again, American politics. They attempted to use force, violence, lies, and religious pressure to make it happen. So all of this night is playing out just as Jesus had warned Peter that it would. Peter, Satan longs to sift you like wheat, he said. But either Peter didn't believe it, or again, out of his pride, he ignored its reality or thought, I can handle this. Have you ever just read this passage and just tried to put yourself there? Can you imagine that moment? That moment when the rooster crowed and he realized what he had done? Now, for some of you, I think you know, because some of you have been to that place. I think a lot of us have been to that place. Where you go, my God, what have I done? And I think the anguish of that moment must have been overwhelming. Suddenly, Peter must have realized he couldn't help but connect the dots and think, I have become Judas. He was that guy. You know, the guy that they always talked about when they were being trained in ministry, and over the 3 years as they were being raised up, that guy that Jesus always warned us about. You know, that guy, not that guy. I don't want to be that guy. The guy who took the road most traveled. And that's a position, that's a path that has been filled over the ages time and time again. You see, there had been two spiritual capital crimes committed that night. Let us not forget that. One was betrayal, and the other was denial. One was Judas, and the other Peter. One would prove he ultimately was not a child of God, and the other would prove that despite his failure, he was. One would die in eternal humiliation, and the other would weep in repentance. It seemed that just beyond these eternal issues that were playing out inside between Jesus and the high priest, there was another scene, a smaller stage, and a far more personal event that was going on just outside with two men. Judas and Peter. Two men who literally stood at the crossroads of their life. The crossroads of their eternity. Both would now manifest their true spiritual standing. And let me tell you something. Everybody in this room will sooner or later show their hand. It may take a while, but we all will get to that moment And it's dramatic. It's an incredibly pressured moment, and the outcome changes everything forever. For Peter, the rooster crowed and signaled his guilt. But please note here, Christian, what Peter didn't know or understand, that that rooster crowed also to express the fact that Peter's night had come to an end. It was a new day. That's why roosters crow. And following his resurrection, Jesus would seek out Peter individually and specifically to express his love and care for him. He says, go back and tell the apostles and Peter. And Peter. Make sure you tell Peter. And then he would deal with Peter on that lake shore in chapter 21 and would commission him back into the ministry. And then finally, we would read on even beyond that. On that day of Pentecost, it would be Peter who would stand up and preach the word, and 3,000 people were born again that day. Same guy. The guy that's no doubt on his face, broken beyond belief at this point, would one day preach one message that 3,000 people would be born again. And then in Acts 4, chapter 5 through 22, Peter would stand before the very men who condemned and crucified Jesus. The very guys who did it. And he would lean in, unflinching and without fear. And he boldly declared to them the gospel. And you read that account, and you think, what happened to this guy? This is Peter, the screw-up Peter? Who denied Jesus that night in the garden, and now he's standing before the very guys who he knows crucified his Savior, and he's unflinching. What happened in those days in between? I mean, how did Peter make it out? Because many of us that are here today, listen, we have a vested interest in knowing the answer to this. Jesus would ask Peter that day on the lake shore when they were having that picnic, he would ask Peter if he loved him. I mean, I can't help but think about the conversation. I would have expected, Peter, what were you thinking, man? Peter, why did you do that, man? Why did you be the chicken? Why'd you turn? What's wrong with you? That's what I would have expected. But actually, the question was, Peter, do you love me? There was no record of scolding. There was no record of promises of never doing such a thing again. It all came to that one single question and its truthful subsequent answer. Peter, do you love me? Because you see, the answer to that question is the fork in the road. Not that night there in the outer temple as he denied Jesus for the third time. That wasn't the crossroads that led him to the crossroads. No. The crossroads was much more simple, much more tangible, if you will, because the crossroads was there on the lakeshore that day when Jesus said, do you love me, Peter? That was the crossroads. It was the fork in the road. It was the question of his life. And the answer, his answer, would decide, even with all of his shortcomings and all of his slip-ups, which I'm sure there were still plenty to come, that would decide whether he would be a Judas or whether he would be a Peter. Just that. See, we too are being asked that question today. And maybe at just such a point of personal failure and crisis, and Jesus is asking, do you love me? Well, do you? Careful now, because words are cheap. And words are easy. Because this is the end of it for all of us. This is the question, and the subsequent answer of this question will determine whether you make it through this or not. Do you love me? Do we truly love him more than anything? More than anyone? More than your job, your money, your comfort, your social status? If so, then Peter, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep, Peter. Let's go do it. Get up, Peter. Let's go change the world. Let's stand. Music team, come forward.